Accession number 31448, Mr. Roy Jones, Real 8. Now, we just got to the point where you're about to go through it all again, training, with this time though with the Royal Marines at in October 48.
Yeah. So, we slept that night, and by the next morning, there was probably 40 of us. And that's when we knew we were then 5-3-4 squad. All squads had a number. Ours was 5-3-4. We were then taken to the barbers. And my mate and I, being old soldiers, I got in the chair and give the fella a couple of bob, and then felt the shears go right over the top of me head. So giving him the two bob didn't make any difference whatsoever. The lot came off, and everybody had the same.
Now, how short was it? Was it sort of crew cut style, or was it sort of...
Yeah, really short, really short. But that I think is done. It was only done ever the once that, where it sort of off. And I think the reason for doing that is because everybody then started with the same length, and they had more control over your head of hair then from them on. And I think that was the reason for that, because after that, the haircuts were as normal, short, but not right over the top. Then we were taken for our uniforms and kit, and you were issued with two sets of blues, a khaki green battle dress like the ones we got when we were issued in the army, a navy blue battle dress, which was what you wore when you were at sea, shirts, socks, boots, PT shoes, and there was two lots of boots. There's ones with the hobnails in, and then there was what they call sea service boots, and they were boots that had just a leather sole, no studs, and a rubber heel, and a pair of shoes, black leather shoes, with no toe cap. Then you were issued with all your equipment, the battle order webbing equipment, with your mesh tins, gas cape, gas mask, tin hat, everything. Oh, the one thing I've left out. When we went to pick up shirts and stuff like that, they already had your name and number on. They were already on. Your brushes for cleaning your boots already have your number on. Incidentally, I've still got mine now, and I use them today to clean my boots. It's funny, but I've still got them, and I've still got my button stick and couple of shoulder flashes and that sort of thing. Then we were taken to the tailors, and the blues, you were measured, and the blues then were tailor altered so that they fit you properly. And you couldn't go ashore until those blues were ready. So we were, from joining, it was probably a month before we could set foot out of the barracks. The equipment, webbing equipment, was khaki green Blanco, as I've already said on the previous tapes, on the early days in the army. So your equipment was Blancoed and that. Then you were issued with your rifle, and you went through the same routine with that. It all had to be cleaned off and everything like that. And that probably took the whole of the second day, while you got all your equipment issued and that. Oh, and by the way, two suits of denims, which were like an overall. But they were made similar to a battle dress. They were in two parts, trousers and a jacket. You got two peak caps, a white one and a navy blue one. A berry, navy blue berry. And a white pith helmet, which you wore on ceremonial parades. After that, that was the first day. The second day, you started in earnest. And the first of it was how to clean your barrack room. And remember me saying early on that when we walked in, the floor looked as if you could see your face in it. Well, we soon got to know how that got there like that, because you were responsible for that. You all had a job, each of you had a job, because you were in a barrack block, and the ablutions for everybody was just off your barrack room. A big open fireplace, but in the winter, coal fires. And alongside that, there was like a big, I don't know whether it was cast iron box with the coat of arms on, and I think a date underneath. It was something like 1860 or something, and that was all nice polished black on the outside and coal on the inside. Little did we know that when it come time for the coal not to be used and the weather was getting warmer, that coal bunker, as I'll call it, or whatever, had to be emptied, and it had to be blank old white. So you can understand, if you've got something that you keep coal in for 6 months of the year, or maybe a little bit less, and then you have to get that empty, spotlessly clean, and then blank old white the inside.
But did you mind that kind of bull?
I've never minded any sort of bull, because, as I said, I think that is a means to an end. It's another form of discipline. And I think with a corps like the Royal Marines, is they will push and push and push until you're at breaking point.
So how would you prepare?
And they do that for a reason. They do that for a reason that it instills the discipline in you, and also that after that, that you question very little. And as far as I'm concerned, that part of the service never ever bothered me. Because I don't think discipline hurts anybody.
So how would you get your room and your kit ready for a full-on inspection? She told us in the army, but you implied it was much worse.
It was much worse.
Whichever you want to look at it.
Then, well, all right, in the Royal Marines, if you were told there was a kit inspection the following day, that kit inspection meant that the room would be inspected as well. So each and every one here had a job to do. So what we did, straight after tea the night before, we'd start on the barrack room. All the lockers dusted and washed, the tops of the lockers. The windows cleaned. All the ledges dusted. Everywhere. Even the ablutions had to be done. So you could do what you could do in the ablutions during the evening, because the following morning you'd have to get in there anyway. You'd do all you could in the barrack room to get the barrack room ready, and then you'd have to start on your kit. And it's hard to explain, really, when you think of the kit that a Royal Marine in my day was issued with. because you got two kit bags, and one was called a sea bag. It was massive. And you got a kit bag that you used to get the same size in the army. And if you're moving anywhere, both of them would be full of your kit. So all that kit had to be laid out on the bed and on the floor in front of your bed. So there was no sleeping in your bed that night, because it would be physically impossible for you to lay your kit on the bed in time for the morning. So what we had to do was lay our kit on the bed of the night time, then sleep on the floor. And you'd start with your mattress would be laid flat. Your blankets, and we had sheets then. Your blankets and sheets would be folded into a box, placed at the head of the bed on top of the mattress with your pillow on top. And then every bit of your kit was laid out in order on the bed. Your boots, the soles of your boots would have to be polished. The studs in the sole of the boot had to be clean. No boot polish on them at all. All your brasswork on your equipment polished, and no sign of any dried brasso had to be found. Your blues would all be hung up behind the bed. Everything polished and brushed and pressed. And all the rest of your equipment laid out on the bed. So it was pretty horrendous, really, and it took, but to get the room and your kits laid out, possibly maybe 5-6 hours, because you knew damn well that if it didn't pass inspection the next day, you're for the high jump. And I've seen it where they've come in to inspect of a morning, and they've gone to one marine's bed, and if it didn't matter what it was, if a certain thing wasn't quite in line, anything like that, he'd just get hold of the end of the mattress and upend the lot and say, lay it again. And there was no questions asked. It had to be done. But as I said before, for me, it's all part of discipline. And I think that is the only reason why they do it. And it's amazing to think, really, how that stands you instead for what's to come. Because the only time you really laid them kits in such a fashion like that was during your time at the depot. Then all you did at the depot was arms drill and marching, and that was 12 weeks, and that's all you done.
No weapons then, just arms drill.
Arms drill and a little bit of weapon training, but not a lot.
And was the drill any different? I mean, was it ever
the hard? Only difference between the Royal Marine drill and Army drill is the fact that when you turn right or left, you don't lift your leg up. You keep your leg straight and sort of click it into your heel. You don't lift your leg up and stamp your foot down like you do in the Army.
Did that take long to get used to after all, you know?
It did take a bit of getting used to, because after doing it for almost 4 years, it's all right for anybody coming straight in on from Civvy Street to do it. Although then again, I would think that with being in the service, that was only a little thing to adjust. It wasn't like somebody coming in from Civvy Street. It must have been horrendous for people coming in straight from Civvy Street into the depot at the Royal Marines. At least we had 3.5-4 years of to get used to things. And although this was harder, it wouldn't have hit us as hard as it hit people coming straight in from Civvy Street. And don't forget that I was almost 22 then. These people coming in were only 17 and 18, some of them. So they were only like boys compared to the likes of me at 22.
Did your instructors realise, I mean, it was on your papers, I presume, but did they realise you'd been through army training?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How did they feel about that? Did they tease you? Or?
No, they said to us was, well, you can forget all about that now. This is totally different, which was true at that point.
So, I mean, do you remember anything about any incidents during that? I mean, it's quite a long time of just lots of drill.
The incidents you make there is if... what they seem to do is if somebody made a cock-up of drill and it carried on for any time, then the whole squad would suffer. And one of the punishments was you're standing there holding your rifle out in front of you like this.
Just both arms straight.
Yeah, perfectly straight with the rifle in front of you. And another favourite one was just to hold the muzzle of the rifle, keep your arms straight, and lift the rifle up off the floor like that. But what it done, I think the reason that the whole squad suffered was then it was left to the whole squad to get onto the bloke who was letting the rest of you down. And I think that was probably harder for the bloke to take than him getting told off by an NCO.
Now, how did you get on with this squad? You'd seen squaddies before. I mean, how did they roam in?
Fine. No problem at all. They seem to be they concentrated a lot more on cleanliness in the Royal Marines than they did in the Army. A whole lot more. Because you'd go on parade and be inspected and it was the sort of thing they'd stand in front of you and say, ground your arms, take your tunic off. And you'd take your tunics off. They'd inspect your braces, because your braces had to be scrubbed. The leather tabs on your braces had to be polished. So looking at it, or another one was, take your boots off. And they'd inspect your socks. If there's any holes in your socks, well, you feel the high jump.
Now, did you realise why cleanliness is... I mean, there is a reason. It's because of...
Yes.
Did you realise at the time?
Yeah, well, I'd had a dose of it in the service, but not as bad. But I think you'd have to be, I don't know, something wrong with you if you didn't know what cleanliness meant, especially if you group together as a group of men. If you get one or two that are not best that way, then they begin to smell, and you can smell them as well. And that only breeds germs and whatever else goes along with it. And it's not very nice if you're hooped up with a gang of lads. And don't forget, in the barrack room, you had 30 or 40 of you in the barrack room, so it had to be kept really clean. And funnily enough, we were taught later on, you dish your own medicine out, the squad did, to people that were not keeping themselves clean. I can highlight that when we come to a later passage.
Okay, we'll save that till later. Yeah. Yeah. So anything else during that period? What were the instructors like compared to the army ones?
When I say to you that we had an instructor at Deal, Colour Sergeant Andrews, he was an absolute gentleman. He was absolutely first class. We had a Corporal Groom, and he had a big moustache, and he slept in the same barrack room as we did. in them days. And incidentally, that particular guy finished up as an RSM, this Corporal Groom. He was a bit of a sod. But when I say a bit of a sod, he was, but he was fair. Which I think you can be. You can be really heavy and strict, but you can be fair. So in that way, you can't really say, you know, criticise him too much. Because after all, they're taking a group of people that have been civvy street all their lives. They come in, their mothers have done everything for them. And now suddenly they've got to start doing it for themselves. It's a totally life-changing situation. That, okay, they've put themselves into that situation because they're all volunteers, bear in mind. None of them were called up. They're all people who've volunteered for this. So then, and the big difference then to now is when you joined then and you signed for 7 years, that was it. That was it. You were in for 7 years. You don't, totally different now where you get the chance to opt out.
So the instructions might be strict and they might be a bit harsh, but they were fair.
Fair.
So they wouldn't pick on someone.
No.
Without reason.
Without reason. And I you see it now where you see read all sorts in the paper about bullying and all this, and I'm not saying for 1 minute that it didn't happen, but I certainly didn't see any of that in my day in the service. I just don't know why it happens like this today. I just don't know. But those instructors we had at Deal were very, very good. Very good indeed.
So anything else new you were learning at Deal? Or anything else you did? A bit of weapons training. I presume that was nothing new to you.
No, which it wasn't. A bit of swimming.
Now, did you have to pass a swimming test?
Pardon?
Did you have to pass a swimming test?
That came later on.
Okay.
Not at Deal. And that was about it at Deal, really.
And how long were you there? October?
12 weeks.
So to January.
Till January, yeah.
And what happened then?
And then January we were moved to Portsmouth.
To what? The barracks?
Yeah, Portsmouth, Eastney Barracks in Portsmouth for naval gunnery. We did the naval gunnery at the Royal Marine Gunnery School, which was just outside the perimeter of the barracks at Eastney. And you did what they call recruits gunnery, which was, they sorted you out there, sort of, for anti-aircraft, ACAC, that sort of thing, and 6-inch and 4-inch.
Now, did they introduce you to each of those things, or just pick you?
They introduced you to each of them, and then they sort of made the minds up then, at which they thought you would excel at best.
And which were you picked for?
And for me, mine was AA.
On any particular gun, Bofors or...?
Pom-poms. And then they... I think it was 8 weeks there.
Now, what do you remember of your training on pom-poms then?
Well, you do the normal thing, like you learn how to operate... a pom-pom.
So tell us a bit about the gun. People don't know what a pom-pom is now.
It's an automatic. It's can't remember the size of the shells it fired. They weren't that big. And they were loaded 5 in a magazine. So there was two of you on a single barrel pom-pom. And one would be the loader, and one would be the layer. And the layer was always the one who did the ACAC course, and he taught other fellas how to load clips of five in, and he used in them days a gyro gun sight.
Now tell me what the layer did then. So that's what you were training as then, really?
Yeah, the layer then would he laid onto the target and fired.
How? How did he lay onto the target?
Well, you used what they call a gyro gun sight. And with that, when you looked through the sight, there was a circle and a dot. The circle would be your barrel, and the dot would be the amount of aim off. Are you with me? So what you did, you honed in onto your target, and you got the dot on the target, and your barrel would be further along, and that was the amount of aim off. And they were fairly accurate, the gyro gun sight. The only thing wrong with them, I think the reason why they got rid of them, when jet aircraft came in, if you traversed too quickly, then the dot would just spin and shoot off to the right. You lost it. So then, all you could do then was hope. You put the barrel on the target and hope that, you know, there wasn't that great deal of aim off for you to... You were all right with an aircraft coming towards you with a gyro gun sight, but anything going across like that, it was no good for. So,
now, did you find that reasonably easy to do? I mean, it sounds quite difficult to me.
I can only speak for myself that I found all that rather easy. And what happened was, if at naval gunnery, recruits gunnery, you got over 80%, you would automatically come back to the gunnery school to do a third class gunnery course at the end of your recruits training. And that's exactly what happened to me and my mate. We both got over 80%. So it was just like as if it was just take to it naturally, and we came back and we did the second class gunnery course, and I got over 80% at that, which meant then I'd do a commission at sea, and after the first commission at sea I would go back and do a second class gunnery course, which you couldn't go any higher than that. So after I finished on the Belfast, I went back to Whale Island and I did the second class gunnery course. And I think on that one I got 79%. So it was sort of something that I just took to. It was the same with the rifle, actually. Even though I say it myself, I was a pretty good shot with the rifle, which I can say more about that later on again.